The number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is... Please note, the new number is...
Blue Roots Radio at BlueRootsRadio.com. Happy Talk with Michelle Happy. Conversations with people about problems and solutions, their causes and effects, and how sharing experiences can help us all to live a better life through service to others.
Welcome to Happy Talk, and today we have with us Rick Stagenborg. This is the second time he's been with us. Hey, Rick, how are you?
Pretty good.
Okay. I hope everybody can hear him. We're as usual, having technical difficulties, so we have Rick on my speakerphone. So today we're going to talk about Soldiers for Peace International, and I wanted to get from you, Rick, some background information on just how you got interested in even starting any kind of an organization that has anything to do with peace.
Sure.
So go ahead.
Well, I grew up during the Vietnam era, and my brother was a Marine in Vietnam, and he was wounded and came home. He was pretty messed up. He'd been out on different kinds of patrols, never talked about it, but I know a little bit about it from talking to other veterans who had his kind of MOS. And he shot himself when he came back. He was hospitalized for a couple of months, and it pretty much shattered my family.
Where did he shoot himself?
Come again?
Where did he shoot himself?
He stuck a gun in his mouth and missed his spinal cord by about an inch. His brain.
Wow. Okay. So he was very, very serious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I thought after Vietnam that we learned our lesson, and I was joined the military myself when I was in medical school,
and so
went active duty in 1989.
So Rick, what prompted you to join the military at the time?
Well, I was going to medical school. I had gone to college for 8 years and decided I better find a real career. So I applied to medical school, and I was accepted. And after a year of being a pauper, I decided to let the military pay for my education and do my time in the service.
Okay.
I didn't mind serving in the military in that capacity, but like I said, I didn't really expect them to start another war, which they did promptly.
And
I was already out by that time.
And what we know now is we can pretty much count on this country to be in continuous war.
Well, I've learned that. I've learned a lot, really, especially in the last year. But I started Soldiers for Peace at the outbreak of the Gulf War in 1990.
Uh-huh.
But without the internet, it was a pretty futile exercise. So I restarted it up again about a year ago, and it seemed to be taking off.
So tell me more about, you know, what Soldiers United for Peace is really about, and then
Sure. Give
me some of that backstory.
Well, it's Soldiers for Peace International, actually, and what it is meant to be is organization is probably the wrong term. Affiliation or network is probably a better term.
Uh-huh.
And what it's meant to do is link together various peace organizations around the world under one umbrella. And it doesn't have a leadership structure. It's kind of anarchical, which is a huge advantage because we don't have to have meetings. We don't have to have minutes. I have a 501(c) that someday will support it. But even that's a fairly organizational structure, but it doesn't have any authority over Soldiers for Peace. Every single member is entirely autonomous. And in fact, most of us don't know each other, which is also an advantage, because if we manage to get on the radar of people that might want to interfere with our activities, they're going to be very unlikely to be able to do that. We're too extended.
So you have tentacles going out everywhere. And are...
Much.
Are most of the members soldiers?
Well, the formal members have to have had military training.
Okay.
They could be active duty, or they could be veterans of any military in the world. But we have a small group of supporters on Facebook and a much, much larger group of supporters who haven't affiliated themselves in any way. I'm working right now, though, on getting affiliations with a group of veterans who are deprogramming active duty military in Fort Lewis, Washington. It looks like we're going to come through with that pretty quick. They'll be our first formal affiliate. I'm also working with Combatants for Peace in Israel and Palestine. We've been talking about perhaps affiliating. So these are traditionally organized groups with boards of directors and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the advantage of my group is just to say that we're all working together, not that we're telling each other what to do, but we, the thing that binds us together is we believe it's possible to end war much sooner than most people believe, and we're going to do it nonviolently. The only requirement to join other than military training is that we take an oath to obey the soldier's creed. No violence unless it's absolutely necessary in defense of self or others.
So how do you propose ending war? What's your plan?
Well, I can only speak for myself, but
right.
My idea is to, I'm personally running for the U.S. Senate. My intent is to introduce a constitutional amendment to abolish corporate personhood, because that's the mechanism that the people that pull the strings in the Senate and pick our senators. That's the mechanism by which they do it. They're able to legally fund networks that can promote certain candidates or smear other candidates using the corporate media. So if I can introduce that constitutional amendment or get Senator Sanders to do it, I'd really rather have him do it, because he's in office now. This could affect the outcome of the 2010 elections. And I'm predicting that once it's introduced, within two election cycles, we'll have the Senate cleaned up. Because all we have to do then is challenge the sitting senators to pick between corporations and their constituents, the humans who elected them.
So Rick, for people who are not really politically oriented or even that well informed, do you want to explain the connection between corporations and war and the military?
Sure, absolutely. At least World War One, the large international corporations have been working together, in a sense, where they have common interests, let's say. They work together to do whatever it takes to maximize their profits. That is the function of corporations. So on an international level, they meet in various groupings, which have gotten to be more and more organized and more structured in such a way that there are key players who can call the shots. And there's evidence that they more or less pick our presidents, and national and transnational corporations pick our senators. Our senators have disproportionate power under the Constitution to make international agreements, such as signing on to the World Trade Organization, which is a non-governmental agency that sort of dictates to various nations what their trade policies are going to be, or else they're subject to sanctions. So they use this power to basically pressure governments into doing what they want. That includes starting wars of choice.
So these bigwigs and these corporations will go to senators and say things like, we need to get involved in some conflict in, say, the Middle East? Okay.
No, they set up situations that force governments to act, and then they, again, they can basically control the corporate media. They have way more money than any other power bloc. And since they control the corporate media, the senators who are career politicians realize that their careers can be ruined just by crossing the wrong people. So they're very careful not to do that.
So, okay, so you say...
And so they end up doing what they want.
Yeah. And, again, I'm going to be asking some questions that might seem a bit naive to you, but I just want everyone to be really clear about what you're saying. So when you say these corporations set up situations, can you give me a scenario?
Well, I don't want to sound paranoid or anything, but we haven't really answered a lot of questions about 9/11.
Uh-huh.
And people that ask too many questions are, for some reason, the corporate media turns on them, which is, in my mind, further evidence that they're covering quite a bit up having to do with 9/11. There's a lot of very, very suspicious circumstances that our public knowledge have never been explained. The 9/11 Commission did not delve into these. It was composed primarily of people who are in quite tight with the power elite in the United States and elsewhere, like James Baker, Madeleine Albright, some of the bigger names that were on the 9/11 Commission. And they... It isn't all deliberate, but they have a certain way of looking at the world that's really quite poisonous.
Well, you know, I have noticed that even in the very liberal media, a lot of people are unwilling to talk about those sort of 9/11 connections, you know, when you start getting into conspiracy stuff. And you're saying that that's because of the corporate media?
Well, sure. Look what happened to Van Jones. You know, supposedly very tight with Obama. The minute he signed that petition asking for a more clear picture of what happened in 9/11, they wanted another inquiry. Obama got rid of him, and I don't think he did that because he wanted to. I think he did it because he was told to.
And what position was Van Jones picked for in Obama's cabinet?
It wasn't that high level. I can't even remember the name of it. It was more of an advisory position.
Uh-huh.
So far, no cabinet-level officer has had the guts to stand up and tell the truth. And I think a really good example of that is Eric Holder. He's just saying bizarre things that make absolutely no sense in the context of a democracy. Just today, actually, I heard on the radio, he was saying that we need to... loosen up on our interpretation of the Constitution when they were dealing with so-called terrorist suspects, which is whoever they designate, of course, American citizens.
Isn't he saying that we have to, it's okay to loosen up on the Miranda rights?
Yeah, that was specifically what I heard him talking about, but I'm sure if he gets away with that, they're going to tell him he needs to push it even further, because I think, I think they're starting to understand that their days may be numbered if they don't tighten down on their control.
They is who? Their base. Who are you speaking of?
The corporate interest.
Oh, okay. So what do you think is, you know, in my own head, I'm trying to picture the organization behind this, and it does get very conspiratorial, like trilateral commission kind of
exactly.
Stuff. Where...
They're one of them, the Trilateral Commission, and the Bilderberg Group is one that I frankly don't know as much about as I should, but Jesse Ventura has been talking about them quite a bit on his television show, which I haven't had a chance to catch yet, internet radio or television, I'm not sure even how to access it. I've never taken time to look it up. But the information is coming out. For instance, JFK's assassination. They've recently uncovered the documents, the FBI files, that prove the FBI knew all along who ordered the hit. At least two in the mafia ordered the hit. Now, who actually ordered the hit isn't public knowledge yet. But I don't see how the CIA... CIA, or excuse me, how the FBI could have covered that up without a CIA okay.
And so when, you know, it's funny because when people start talking this way, you run the risk of getting smeared, essentially.
Of getting what?
Smeared. Excuse me, my husband's phone's ringing here in the background. Okay.
Okay.
So
getting what?
Smeared. You know.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah.
Of course, that's how they operate. And that's why people who are in positions of power really don't want to say this. It's those of us who haven't gotten in those positions who are able to speak freely, because what are they going to do to me, for instance?
Right, right. And does it, I mean, does it, so obviously it doesn't worry you in terms of, because you're running for Senate in the Green Party. Do any of the Green Party people come at you and say, you know, hush, hush, don't be talking about this stuff? Just because, you know, it, the mumming can come from many angles, you know, either those who are motivated to smear you or those who are motivated to keep, you know, sort of keep things safe, quote unquote.
Well, the ironic thing is that the only people in the Green Party that are trying to shut me up are ones who have personal agreements against me. And the biggest thing that they disagree is they've convinced themselves that I'm not any war enough.
That's interesting.
I don't want to get too deeply into it. I don't want to make them embarrassed if it gets out.
The concern is that you're not anti-war enough.
Yeah, my original position on ending the wars, I made the mistake of simply mentioning that we may be inadvertently doing something good in Pakistan, and that was enough to convince pinheads who don't really understand politics or war that I was not really anti-war.
Because
these are people who, as far as I know, none of them have ever served in the military, and they don't really understand the geopolitical implications of what we're doing, other than the intent is to tighten control of the oil supplies and so that they can manipulate prices, and they don't care who they kill on the front. I'm aware of all this stuff, but that wasn't the point I was making. I was just saying that inadvertently we may be allowing Pakistan to stand up as a democracy, fight terrorism within their borders, make peace with India, and since they're both nuclear powers, that seems to me like a good thing.
Uh-huh.
It's not a justification for us being there, but we're there, so I just pointed out that may actually be a good thing.
So the meme of the day is you're supposed to hate Pakistan. So if you see something that could be constructive going on there and you're not 100% against it, then you're seen as not fitting in this, to whatever.
Well, by a few people. I don't want to say that nobody in the Green Party has any common sense. Most of them do.
Right.
They've elected Green Party members in Germany and just recently in England. And I think the Green Party movement is much more vibrant in Europe, but it's growing here in the United States by leaps and bounds because people are getting sick and tired of the Democrats and the Republicans pretending to wrestle when, in fact, they're both working for the corporations.
Well, and that's the frustrating thing, you know, is it is hard to explain when you look at the Democratic Party platform. It's really hard to explain some of the directions that that party goes, especially for me. I mean, I'm a Buddhist, so it's a no-brainer for me. I'm against all war, no matter what, for a theological reason, and just because in my guts, I just don't get it. I don't understand how, you know, I just don't get it. Why? I remember when I was a kid, I used to say they should just play chess or something. Why do they have to? Why do
well,
they have
think
to kill each other?
Chess, but they're really playing checkers. War is a n-dimensional game, and in order to play it, you need to think outside the hypercube, and they don't.
Right.
They don't even understand the concept. They don't understand the concept. Let me put it this way. The difference between... between people that think that war is inevitable and people that understand that we have to end it is that they think that people are basically evil and need to be controlled, and we think that people are basically good and need to be freed to reach our full human potential.
Yes, and I think that people are capable of both, and in order to, you know, to become peace-loving, compassionate people, you have to work really, really hard at it on a daily basis because there's something in us.
It depends on how you're brought up. A lot of, you know, I've worked with, as a psychiatrist, I've worked with people of all types. And what I've discovered is that the people who have I don't want to use the term conservative because it has its good side too, but I guess neoconservative, this crazy idea that conservatism is all about power and controlling people. This is not your traditional conservatism. This is the kind of conservatism that people who are beaten as children come to adopt because they think that's the way everything is. We all have a tendency to think that everybody has a common experience, and what we don't realize is these early childhood experiences color the way we look at the world. So
every
person lives in their own individual reality. They don't understand that theirs is a very distorted reality.
I think that's just such an important point to make. And I mean, you're talking in my area now, Rick. And you know, I think about Clarence Thomas and the type of Supreme Court judge he is. And then I learn about his childhood, and he, you know, he was abandoned by his parents, and his grandfather raised him. I think it was his grandfather, and he suffered a lot of abuse, and both emotional and physical. And so in my mind, he is damaged.
He's very damaged. He's so damaged that he can't see. He is a product of affirmative action, and now he's totally against affirmative action because he's convinced himself he did everything on his own, and if he can do it, anybody can do it. But he doesn't realize that he was helped all along the way by people who appreciate how difficult it is for a black man to succeed starting out with that many disadvantages. And not just black men, but poor whites, same thing.
Right. So the way I think about him is that he just had all the compassion probably beaten and abused out of him. And that he...
It seems like it.
And you know, I'm using him as an example, but I think it's true for many people who were abused as children, is you, something gets knocked out of you, and it makes it very difficult to reconnect to that kernel or seed of compassion. And a lot of people who are abused will end up being parents and will slip right into the same pattern because of a lack of...
That's all they know, and they think that's the way you're supposed to raise children.
Right. That's right. And they're also, what happens, and I know we're waxing a bit psychological here, but what happens when you're abused is you don't get properly soothed. And, you know, it's very important for parents to soothe their children and make everything okay. And then for children to eventually learn how to soothe themselves. And if you don't have this self-soothing ability when you become a parent and you get stressed out, you can't talk yourself down, so you just lash out.
Right, and this has lots of implications. It's really impossible to explain this to the layman without introducing some basic psychological concepts.
Right, and
such
then,
as the key critical task in development at the age of 2 years old is to establish independence. And this is what these people who are abused as children never learn. They're not given the nurturing and the encouragement to be independent. If they're raised by authoritarian parents, they're absolutely convinced they must submit to authority, or they instinctively expect to be punished. And they think about everything in terms of punishment and reward.
That's right. And that's so true. And so when you look at the personality differences between liberals and conservatives, you see a much more authoritarian streak in conservatives. So you know, when you start talking politically and you bring in the whole concept of psychological damage, that doesn't go over so well, does it?
Well, I don't, you know, I don't make I use it more in my psychotherapy work than I do in politics, but I'm cognizant of it because it makes me aware of who I'm dealing with. Usually people don't, they don't have a strong negative reaction toward me unless I challenge their assumptions.
Uh-huh.
And I do it deliberately. I challenge their assumptions to force them to think about things they've never thought about before.
Right.
I do it in politics. I do it in psychotherapy. I do it in every aspect of my life.
Yeah. And, you know, if you, in terms of peace, if you grow up in one of these authoritarian homes, and of course, you know, our parents, when we're children, our parents are seen in the role of being God. They are a God figure to us. Until we...
Right, they're supposed to encourage children to realize that they're people too, and as the kids get older, they're supposed to loosen up on the restrictions, encourage their independence, and that is supposed to start at age two.
Yeah.
Children begin to develop the capacity to, they want to explore, that they need to feel safe.
Yeah.
To, as you said, that it's okay to be independent, and if you take that away from them, they really become dependent on other people telling them what to do.
And so what happens is if they get a little bit too independent, they'll have a natural consequence, which will rein them in, and they'll have that feedback loop started where they'll get to get a sense for themselves of what is dangerous and what isn't. Is that what you're saying?
That's the hope.
Yeah. I always tell people, if you right. want an independent child, you nurture them and give them as much love as you can, and they will grow up being incredibly independent. And it's interesting because that really runs counter to a lot of people's assumptions based on coming up in what I consider our culture, which is pretty sick. This American culture.
People are encouraged to be independent from the beginning. They can learn fairly early on that they're really ultimately going to have to be responsible for themselves. And if they don't, they may never learn that. They may depend on leaders to tell them how to think, what to do. If they snap their fingers and say it's time to go to war, they say, yes, sir, how high do I have to jump?
Right. Rather than...
This is what breeds a culture who assumes that war is necessary sometimes. And when our politicians tell us, well, we don't have a choice. We have to go to war to defend us, and start throwing out all these buzzwords like freedom and liberty and justice and all this stuff that they pervert the meaning of in an Orwellian sense. They're speaking doublespeak. All they really care about is keeping their jobs.
Well, and you know, when you look at our culture, wouldn't you say that about, it's probably more than 50-50 authoritarian in terms of upbringing of children. Do you have a...
No, I don't think so. I think it's less than 50-50, but the thing is, these are the ones that grow up with very strong emotional reactions, stepping outside of what they think is group the common reality. They just assume it, and they're loud and they're aggressive, and so people like me who are pacifists have a tendency to want to avoid that kind of conflict. They're like you said, they suffered the consequences of taking chances, and some of them are kind of risk averse. I'm not one of them. I don't care if my efforts lead to the result that I want, which is world peace. I wouldn't care. I couldn't care less if they assassinate me. I mean, it has nothing to do with the mission. I was trained as a soldier. I understand how they think, and this is a war for human survival.
Yes, and so sort of to like put it all together, the people, what you're saying is the people who come up in these, what I would call dysfunctional homes that are authoritarian, end up in high places because of stridency. Is that what you're saying?
That's part of it, but they're also tools. Since they don't understand their own motivation, they're easily manipulated by people who know that they can use them for their own selfish ends.
And the best way to manipulate people is through fear, right?
Well, fear, or, I mean, it's a carrot and stick thing. You know, offering somebody a Senate seat is pretty powerful inducement to get them to do what you want. If they, especially if they're authoritarian and they're inclined to listen to powerful figures who are in a position to reward or punish them.
Right, right. And so, we're in trouble, aren't we?
How's that?
Well, we're in trouble just because the system is so pervasive. And obviously, you see a way out of that. And that's what I'm really curious about. Yeah.
Yeah, I do. Well, as I mentioned on the last show, I'm writing a book about how we can accomplish this. It's fairly complicated. It involves a lot of factors. But because I have a specific plan, I'm able to sort of monitor various sources of information. And a lot of these ideas are getting out there. I'm not saying that I alone am getting them out there, but I am trying to promote them on the internet. The ideas that need to become part of our collective consciousness, part of our consensus reality, in order to make the idea of war unthinkable.
Yeah, you know, I of course follow the Dalai Lama, and I follow him on Facebook too. And I put a lot of his quotes up on my Happy Talk fan page, because that's exactly what he's trying to do too.
Oh yes, and I met a Nepalese, I think it was Nepalese Buddhist, who is convinced that the Dalai Lama is in his last incarnation, which is very interesting, because if that's true, that could only mean that the mission that is his soul was incarnated for in the first place is about to be accomplished. I happen to think that's true.
And the idea of the Dalai Lama being in his last incarnation is interesting because, you know, with Karmapa, which is another high lama of Tibet, the Chinese just absconded with this little 4-year-old tuku, the Karmapa, and replaced him with another one. And
right. Well, the Chinese are about to get a big surprise, I think.
In what sense?
It's too late for them to stop the Buddhist movement.
Yeah. Yes, it's...
Or Falun Gong. It's all converging on the same outcome.
Uh-huh. Well,
there's a change in human consciousness that's taking place, and I believe it's going to go exponential very soon. I call it the tectonic paradigm shift in the book.
Huh. And your book is called Stop the Madness?
Yes, Stop the Madness, The Diary of a Soldier for Peace in the War to Take Back America.
So you get into detail about all this stuff in the book.
Yes.
Obviously, I haven't read it. I'm not a very good talk show host, but...
Well, it can be found on the website of soldiersforpeaceinternational.org.
Mm-hmm.
It's linked to it as it's a separate website. It's linked to it.
Okay. And it's a book in progress, too, isn't it? You're adding chapters as you go.
Right. And it is essentially a diary. I put down my thoughts about what I think is most important at each step of the way. I wrote about, I don't know, maybe 25 chapters. Just sort of outlining my basic thinking about what needed to happen in order for war to become unthinkable. And I'm fleshing it out now with other ideas and things that occur to me as I'm out and about talking to people like you.
So one of the things you're saying that needs to happen is a different form of child rearing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, I haven't written about that. Well, I've alluded to it in a couple of essays. It's a book of essays. But I haven't really gone into depth in it. That's a good idea. I probably need to do that fairly soon.
I'm a person who likes to look at the cause and deal with the cause rather than just only focusing on the effects and dealing with the effects.
Well, what I'm doing is focusing on the things that need to be done first. The book is that the essays are not random. They're written in a certain order. If people study them and understand their implications, then they'll eventually come to the same understanding I have. Some people already understand a lot of it, and it's very easy reading. For other people, it's a more difficult because they've never thought of these concepts before.
Absolutely. I mean, you're introducing a new paradigm, and paradigm shift comes with a lot of upheaval and pain before. And I think we may have talked a little bit about this on the first show, before it becomes fully accepted. So, you know.
Right. One of the essays I wrote is called Believing is Seeing. And the concept is that until you believe something's possible, you won't even try to work for it. Most people don't think the end of war in our lifetime is possible. I do.
Uh-huh.
I know how to do it, I think. But it depends on really a shift in human consciousness, and that's really what the book is about.
Well, and it's like, maybe people, all the catastrophes that are happening, you know, that unfortunately it's kind of part of human nature that in order to see how foolish offshore drilling is, you have to have a level of catastrophe that's going on right now in the Gulf of Mexico, which just breaks my heart. There's got to be an easier, softer way, you know?
Well, I don't think there is. Another one of the essays is called Thank God for George Bush.
Yeah. No, he did a lot of good.
Well, he inadvertently did a lot of good because he revealed basically what the corporatocracy is about.
Right.
He made it so obvious that started waking up and realizing we had to act now. We can't wait because the world is on the brink of self-destruction, which is something that religious fundamentalists, they are fully aware of this. And they are either shaking in their boots or jumping for joy because they think Jesus is going to come down on a white horse with a flaming sword and kill all the people that don't think like they do. And unfortunately, a lot of them, probably the vast majority, are authoritarian. And they simply don't get that God gave us free will so that we can choose between whether we want heaven or hell on earth.
Yeah. And, you know,
collectively.
What's interesting is in the Buddhist cosmology, they say that we are in the age of degeneration right now and that things are going to, just get worse and worse.
I think we're about to enter the age of Aquarius.
I thought we entered that in, what was it, the 90s?
Well, I'm not sure. I don't study astrology, but I understand that's the 12th house and the final stage of enlightenment. And I think that human society is about to enter the age of Aquarius. Some of us have been there for a while.
Well, what I hope is...
getting close to it.
Yeah. When they started talking about using a nuke on the oil gusher, I just thought, geez, I hope we don't get this lesson by doing something like that. You know, I mean.
You know what? I actually suggested that jokingly, and then they came out and said they were actually thinking about it. I couldn't believe it.
They were. And it's like, I don't know. I can't say I'm actually frightened about the way things seem to go, but I agree with you about George Bush. I remember I went to a Democratic picnic here in my little county, Douglas County, Nevada, and people were just amazed at how many others were there. And they were saying, my gosh, I've never seen so many people at a Democratic event. And I kept saying, well, we have George Bush to thank for that. He was, and I mean that in all seriousness, he was an incredible unifier when you, and it sure, he is responsible for me getting very actively involved in learning about politics, because I was so concerned about how deeply he, and particularly Cheney, and then the Supreme Court were literally tearing down our democratic fabric, the small d democracy.
They've been doing it for 100 years, but it was a slow process until recently. They're accelerating their efforts because I think they realize now that we're all interconnected by the internet that we can evolve our human consciousness, and we're starting to, and I think they see the signs of pushback, and so they deliberately decided to, first of all, have another happy little war so that they could scare us all and control us with fear, and then to institute their anti-democratic changes so that we would accept fascism as a fact of life.
As being the, you know, from their paradigm, the more efficient, safer way to live, fascism, right?
Right, yes. Benjamin Franklin, as everybody knows, said, those who give up freedom for security deserve neither.
Right. And so, you know, I think we are at the cusp of something, and I'm always really loath to get a whole bunch into predictions because you really never know, but it does feel like we're on the cusp of something. And I do sense that we're going to have to see a lot more trauma as a result, or karma as a result of some of these things that have been put into place. And, you know, when the Supreme Court made that decision on corporate personhood, but on this Citizens United case most recently, you know, my thought was, this could be a good thing because it's going to get...
Yes, exactly. I tell people, that night I had a good drunk. I was celebrating.
Uh-huh.
I wrote an essay that morning called A Bridge Too Far.
Right.
Which talks about how this was a key thing that was going to wake up the American people, unite liberals and conservatives into action, which will be to abolish corporate personhood through a constitutional amendment. And I'm working on that in several different ways, actually.
Yes, I really think it did have that effect of, like, alerting people, at least people who are have some political savvy or interest in the news, to think, what? I mean, that just makes no sense at all. And then the whole concept of corporate personhood was further revealed, you know, how it started. When was that? In the 1800s? There was some, was it in the
1886 in Santa Clara, they came up, they actually ruled against it for the 20th time or so. The railroads kept coming back, trying to get this passed. They packed the Supreme Court with people that came from the railroad industry. And at that time, the Chief Justice was actually a railroad man. And so was the clerk of the court. Well, the Chief Justice knew that this was utter crap. It was totally unconstitutional. And he said so both in deliberations and in the decision. But the clerk actually put something completely different in the header when he wrote up a brief description of it for the annals of the Supreme Court decisions of 1886. And 20 years later, during a period of Supreme Court pushback against Teddy Roosevelt trying to rein in corporate power, the Supreme Court suddenly decided that could be the basis for reversing really 100 years of precedent, is what I understand, when you look also at the basic constituents of the doctrine of corporate personhood. They reversed roughly 100 years of precedent by relying on that, so it was decided in error. That's being charitable. I think it was decided on purpose.
So you don't think it was a clerical error, Rick?
It was illegitimately. I'm talking about the Supreme Court in, I believe it was 1906. They came up with the first explicit statement that corporate personhood is a valid constitutional construct, and they based it on the fact that corporations are described as persons in the law. Traditionally, they've been described as part educational persons, but they decided all of a sudden that the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause that refers to the rights of persons applied to corporations too. And we've been having to deal with consequences of that since Reagan came in office, because everybody knew it was complete horse manure. After Reagan came in and smiled his big smile and said, gee whiz, corporations will save us from, the likes of Jimmy Carter, that rotten peacenik and environmentalist, corporations will save us. All we got to do is put our faith in these soulless creations of man that exist only for profit among the rich on the trickle-on theory, the trickle-down theory. But we all know what trickled down from that, and except for the most deluded people, understand the trickle-down theory is I guess it's horse piss by analogy.
It's a myth.
That's where we get trickle-down on us.
Right, it's a myth.
Yes, it's a myth, and Rush Limbaugh likes to scream that Roosevelt is dead, and we need to kill all his policies and New Deal, but Milton Friedman is dead too, Rush.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, the challenge, and I wonder how you deal with this when you hear somebody like Rush Limbaugh or, Hannity or any of those people, how do you keep from getting into your own anger and reactiveness?
Well, I had to deal with that. I was brought up with such a keen sense of justice. I used to literally shake with rage when I saw an act of gross injustice occurring right in front of me. But between working with war veterans and helping them deal with their rage issues, that was very helpful for me. And in looking at the roots of my own anger and realizing the pointlessness of it and the counterproductivity of it and the deleterious effect it had on my own mental health, pretty much given up on anger. I think it's a useless emotion.
It's not even
emotion. 99 times out of 100, what anger is it's a substitute for fear or hurt.
That's right. So it isn't even a primary emotion. It's a secondary emotion.
It's a secondary emotion.
Yeah, and in Buddhism we say that anger is a poison, and that all poisons need to be transformed into compassion, and there's some pretty simple methods by which to do that. I don't think it's enough to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps and say, okay, well, I just won't be angry anymore, because we have, when we experience...
We're creatures of habit, and we need to consciously decide we're going to give up our anger. It involves... See, it's easy for a Buddhist to do, because you already have the basic you need in order to achieve that stage of enlightenment. But if you're not a Buddhist, you have to come about it a different way. And the Christians, the real Christians who understand that Jesus' central message was love each other as brothers and sisters, for them it's not as hard either. They can let go of anger too. A lot of people, not just Christians, Buddhists, Hindus, and Muslims too, for the most part, believe that there's a reason for everything, because even if we do have free will, God is guiding us and God is still speaking to us. That's what one of the commonalities of the religions are. But again, fundamentalists, they focus on totally irrelevant aspects of these religious literature, and then they twist it to mean what they want it to mean.
And
based on their own sick assumptions.
That's right. And if I could just clarify a little bit about Buddhism, because we don't believe in a creational God in Buddhism, but we believe that we are all Buddhas, that we all have Buddha nature, and what separates us from that are obscurations, and those are the obscurations that the ego creates, and so.
Right.
Really, for enlightenment is nothing other than unfolding and letting go of and transforming those obscurations into compassion, and then you wake up.
And I think that's totally consistent with basic Christian and Muslim theology.
Right.
What Christ, I think, tried to teach us was that all distinctions between us are artificial. We impose them on ourselves. It's a tribal mentality. And we need to let go of that to bringing heaven to earth, or however you want to conceptualize that.
Uh-huh.
And I agree with the Buddhist concept that God is all of us.
Yes. Yes. So, and that's what we have, you know, if you're in a peace organization, it's so easy to get angry at injustice. I mean, it is so easy. And then you lose the whole purpose of being a pacifist, and you say you're a pacifist. I believe you, and I certainly am myself, even though I can find myself getting really irritated at times.
I think I could kill to save someone or to save myself, but then only because I think that I have an important mission to accomplish. Otherwise, I wouldn't kill to save myself.
Right, or a child, you know, to protect a child.
Well, I would definitely kill if I had to.
Right.
Not if I had a choice.
Right.
But if I absolutely had to, if somebody was holding a knife to the throat of a child, for instance, I'd blow them away in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, I could. I used to say, if anybody, my son's a grown man now, but when he was little, I used to say if anybody threatened him, I'd rip their throat out with my teeth, you know. So I don't feel that way anymore. And I think part of it is because I'm a little bit more advanced in my Buddhism. And he's also a grown man busy protecting his own child. And so it goes, right? Well, Rick.
Well, I think the body is transitory. We're nothing but a distortion in space-time. You know, we all going to die sometime.
Yep.
And if somebody wants to take the moment that I'm going to have to take them out, I guess that's how it's going to be. But I don't expect that to ever happen. Nobody has ever been stupid enough to put themselves in a position where I had to do more than hurt them a little bit to get them to stop.
So I guess that's your good karma,
the
huh?
People that are trying to control the world, they're a little bit more stubborn and a little bit more big-headed, and I think we're going to have to hurt them a lot. We're going to have to take away their toys. All we got to do is deprive them of their means of power and wealth, and that's all they care about. So they're going to be hurt really bad by that, but that's the way it goes.
And, you know, they accumulate karma also. There's a great movie. It's an old movie called The Doctor with William Hurt. And he is a surgeon, and he's quite an asshole. You know, he's a very arrogant, wealthy surgeon, and he ends up coming down with cancer and learns humility and how to be a better doctor and a better person through that. It's really a wonderful, transformative movie, and I think that would even be possible for Dick Cheney to have.
Yes, I do, except I think die first. You know, he had another serious episode of angina recently. He's had four heart attacks, and he's accumulated so much karma that I think he's not long for this world.
Well, and it's interesting too that his problem is in his heart. So
yes, I like to say that Dick Cheney has a very sick heart.
Yes. Yeah.
I think that's obvious to everybody but Lynn.
So Rick, I want to thank you. We have only about 3 minutes left to go, and I'm sitting here holding my phone in such a way that I'm going to have a terrible stiff neck if I continue much longer. So is there anything you want to close with? I want to give you a chance to promote whatever it is that you want to promote and to tell people.
Sure. I encourage people to talk to their neighbors, regardless of what their political persuasion is, about corporate personhood.
Uh-huh.
This is a concept that anybody can understand and explain, and it's really the critical thing we need to fight in order to win this war, to take back the country for democracy, for the people. And if we do that, we'll have world peace quicker than most people can imagine. I also want to encourage people, I didn't mention, civilians can join us on Facebook. We don't want to leave anybody out that wants to become a soldier for peace. So it's everybody in the nobody out, just like the healthcare system we're going to have once we take the country back. And the only people that probably won't join eventually are the ones that we're out to get, and that's just too bad for them.
Right. And what is your website?
It's soldiersforpeaceinternational.org. I also have a personal Facebook page that I pretty much friend to anybody. And I have Soldiers for Peace International Facebook page. And I have also the website, staggingforyourusenate.com.
So really the easiest way, if you're a member of Facebook, is just to type your name, Rick Staggenborg, in the search and befriend you, and through that can find out all your other stuff.
Yeah, I mentioned for Peace International periodically to encourage people to join that Facebook page also.
Okay, great. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and it turned into a really interesting discussion. I hope you feel like we covered what you wanted to cover.
You're a wonderful interviewer, and I learn something every time I talk to you.
Okay, good. We'll have to do it again.
Let's do that.
Okay, thanks, Rick. See you soon.
You bet. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. So, Chris, are you there?
Standing by.
So it went, that was very interesting. I always think it's going to be something, and then it always turns into something else. So
the best interviews turn out that way.
Yeah, that was really, really fun. So I want to give a plug to our blog, and because our blog has a new home now, which you can't tell from being on it. It looks the same, but the URL is a bit different. You just go to blueRootsRadio.com, and that takes you
that's our right. Only address, as it should be.
Right.
And
there you have the ability to access, can podcasts be accessed from there yet?
Yes. The podcasts are there on the, yours would be on the Happy Talk page. It's, those are at the top.
Uh-huh.
The podcast, I'll be working on it just as soon as we finish here and have it available, this evening. And it's also available on iTunes. There's the link also at mhappy.com.
And all those links work. I checked them. So everything's running really smoothly. And also, I want to just say that for people who feel like it's difficult to find a good news source, Blue Roots Radio, the peanut butter thread, is the place to find the news of the day. Tony D does just an amazing job of compiling the news. So if you feel like it's too much trouble, just go there.
She starts before Morning Joe, and she is still going after Rachel says goodnight. So
that's right.
You will get, if you want to know what Rachel's talking about tonight, read Tony D in the morning, because she will have it there. And it's not just one story. She has the uncanny ability to pick the stories that you really want to know about. So you just tie it all together. It's a great thing.
So it's a very fun place to go. And it's funny, there's all this controversy about Facebook now and privacy, which is something I think is kind of oxymoronic in a way, to expect privacy out of a social networking. I know they're using the information, but I don't know. I can't get exercised about it. Are you?
Well, only because I don't use it that much anymore.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I get over there when I can, but I've been so busy lately with this blog stuff. And in a way,
right,
they kind of are competition, but it all levels out in the end.
Yes, it does. And so anybody who's frustrated with Facebook, just head on over to BlueRootsRadio.com, because it is a community of really great people.
It's a lot closer. I mean, because you got a smaller audience, and you really, I've got now 300 friends on Facebook. I don't know 2/3 of these people really, like I know, the bloggers over at Blue Roots.
Yeah, it's a intimate, pretty intimate internet setting, and we're always open to new people coming in.
But it's real spiffy too.
And it's we have some, you know, we've got the cream of the crap over there. So we've got some really classy graphic artists and intellectuals and humorists and just some of the best people.
We've got the technical gurus. We've got the graphic people. We've got people that have the social skills and the social wherewithal to do things. It's just, the gestalt of that blog far exceeds the individual members.
That's all. Right. And everybody does everything they do there on a volunteer basis, including me doing this show. You know, I have my day job. You have your day job. We all have our day jobs, but we put a lot of effort and work into what's going on over there. You know, how many shows now? We have You Think, Happy Talk, your 3-hour commentary and music show, The Reasonist.
Mm-hmm. And more to come.
More to come. So keep in touch. Okay, thank you.
Do you have anything else left to say?
I do not. I'd like to say who's going to be on the show next week, but it's between two different people. So I'll just announce that on Facebook. And if you want to get those announcements, just fan me at Happy Talk, HAPPE Talk on Facebook. And my website is mhappy.com. And that's all I want to say.
All right, Michelle, we'll see you next week.
Okay, thanks.
This has been Happy Talk with Michelle Happy. You can find a podcast of today's broadcast at mhappy.com, iTunes, or BlueRootsRadio.com. Happy Talk with Michelle Happy.